The McLean County Board's even split requires bipartisanship. The county administrator says that's a good thing.
There could be concern that we stall action as a county, but thus far it has not been a problem.
That's next on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good afternoon, I'm John Norton. Also on today's show, a Bloomington man who got a new kidney encourages others to give the gift of life.
That 18-year-old boy who suddenly passed away still lives on beside me.
Plus, a philosopher who coined the term hempathy comes to ISU with a lecture on mansplaining and gaslighting.
Metaphorically, I define misogyny as the law enforcement branch of patriarchy.
Those stories follow a Bloomington Normal News update, which is just ahead. This is WGLT Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org, part of the NPR network.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. Hear My Story continues with local patient Bill Mackay.
So she put those things on and all of a sudden, poof, it was a full, rich sound that I could finally hear. But I remember having a tear in my eye because it was all of a sudden, why did I wait so long?
Bill's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
From the campus of Illinois State University in Normal, this is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. It's been a relatively quiet last few months in McLean County government as new county board members get up to speed on county operations. The county board replaced over one-third of its members last fall. County Administrator Cassie Taylor tells WGLT's Eric Stock one key issue board members might need to confront soon is carbon sequestration. That's where liquefied carbon dioxide is transported through pipelines drilled into the rock deep underground.
So I know there are a lot of fears with those efforts, with how it might impact our aquifer or how it might, the setbacks might impact our citizens. And so the county is trying to be very deliberate in doing research. And so we have work groups that are set up right now through the leadership of Leah Klein, who is our Land Use and Development Committee Chair. And so what we're trying to really discover is what is our role with county government? What influence do we have over that process? And then what action would we want to take with regard to that? And what we're finding is we have no authority over the pipeline itself. That is governed by the ICC, the Commerce Commission. But we would have some authority, we think, with the setbacks and adding some language to our zoning code, where we might be able to have some influence there in how the setbacks are set, or also what protections we would like to include in our language to make sure that all the EPA regulations are being upheld.
What kind of protections do you foresee the county looking for?
Well, the main protection, I believe, will be the water supply, making sure that we protect our aquifer, that our water supply is protected, and make sure that in the case that there would be a rip in the pipeline or a problem with any of the well sites, that we would have safeguards in place, proper training for our first responders, proper equipment for our first responders, and information to our citizens so they understand what to look for and what to be concerned about.
McLean County government has boosted pay for its employees across the board following a study that showed the county was underpaying many based on comparable size communities. How much of an adjustment was this, and how long will it take the county to get to where it should be?
So our salary study did identify that McLean County overall was about 7% behind our comparable counties in our compensation. And so the first year of adjustments would impact those employees that were identified as being under market. And so those adjustments have been made. They were put in place the first payroll of this year, January of 2023. And so the second adjustment that will take place in January of 2024 will then give additional increases to those who have been identified as long-term employees that need a longevity adjustment. And so many of the salaries had adjustments in the range, and then some individual employees had adjustments in their salaries. So It was individualized per employee, but we found that overall we needed to increase that by about 7%.
As we continue on Sound Ideas with McLean County Administrator Cassie Taylor, McLean County is implementing its updated mental health action plan. How much impact do you feel the county's health plans are having at this point?
I really am excited about the new way we are approaching our mental health action plan this year. We have a new director, Kevin McCall, and the Behavioral Health Coordinating Council is conducting work groups of all of the different areas of priority that were included in the mental health action plan. So we are currently putting together work groups for areas of justice-involved, behavioral health, crisis, youth, access to medical services, and housing. And so I believe that branching out to the community and including more people in the dialogue and conversation about what our priorities should be and then setting goals from those priorities is going to be something that we can accomplish in a different way in 2023 than we have in the previous years. And of course, everyone's tired about talking about COVID, but I do think that that impacted some of the momentum that we could have realized in the last couple of years. So we're back at it.
So how would you sort of define the difference between what's being done now versus before? Just more outreach to various groups or?
Outreach, but identifying a mission for the group. So with the coordinating council, there would be meetings where it was a lot of reporting out of information that was going on in the community, but there's more of an action focus to these work groups to really identify goals that we can accomplish, timelines for those goals, and who's going to take up, you know, the mantle and take responsibility for those goals.
Now that the COVID pandemic is winding down, many local governments have become fairly flush with cash to take on some major projects through COVID relief, including infrastructure. How much impact has that money had, and what happens when this funding goes away?
We have been very careful in how we utilized our COVID-related funds, including our ARPA funds, our American Rescue Plan Act funds. And so we really focused on some of those needs that had been diverted or delayed due to lack of funding in the county. And so many of our projects relate to infrastructure and our one-time payments to upgrade some of the facilities that we have. And then the biggest thing that I'm excited about with our ARPA funds is the ability to use those funds for our Aegis project. So when we started down the road with our electronic justice system project and received information back from our consultants, we were told that it would be a $30 to $35 million project. And of course, there was a little bit of sticker shock with that kind of a figure for our justice system software. ARPA has helped us to realize those dreams and make sure that our system is integrated, even using the best of breed model that was identified for the county. And so we're able to use about $10 million of our county ARPA funds for the project. And then we are also able to use our special mental health and safety fund dollars to help with that, that we receive from the city and the town.
As we continue on Sound Ideas with Cassie Taylor, McLean County Administrator, and we've seen a number of issues that have divided the county board in recent years, some almost entirely along party lines. The extension funding was one of them. Electronic devices for jail inmates, even county board appointees. Do you see the board becoming increasingly political? And has that changed at all since a third of the board has changed over since last year?
Our, as you know, we have a 10-10 split in our county board. We have 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats that sit on our board. And I have been impressed with the county board as it sits today in their ability to have conversations and express disagreements while maintaining decorum and really listening to the other side. And so they sat the new board members in December And even though there haven't been, we haven't always had agreement in all the issues, I believe that there is understanding with this board, and they're really trying hard to work together for the good of McLean County.
Does the even split impact the dynamic at all, as opposed to the, quote, majority party versus the minority party, and it's completely 50-50 across all committees now, all subcommittees, leadership positions within those committees?
So, yeah, so that's a change that was made this year, and the number of people sitting on committees was changed from 7 to 6 so that we could have an even split between the parties. And so that can be a challenge if you have a contested issue, because as you know, if it's a tie vote, it fails. And so there could be concern that we stall action as a county, but thus far it has not been a problem. And I think that the board has really looked at the good of McLean County, and the right outcomes have been moved forward.
So I guess in this case, any measure truly must have bipartisan support to pass.
Correct.
That was McLean County Administrator Cassie Taylor speaking with WGLT's Eric Stock. Sound Ideas is WGLT's news magazine. I'm John Norton. Signing up for organ donation has never been easier, but there are still not enough donors to keep up with demand. April is National Donate Life Month. In this edition of WGLT's Sound Health, healthcare administrators say they hope personal stories will encourage more people to give the gift of life.
In your love and mercy, you turn the sadness of death into the dawn of new life.
Molly Ward, Director of Spiritual Care at Carl Broman Medical Center, opened with a prayer outside the hospital in Normal, and an officer raised a Gift of Hope flag to encourage organ donation. Adam Lovell of Bloomington had his prayers answered. Lovell needed a new kidney and pancreas because of his diabetes and complications from a foot injury. His foot got infected and he was hospitalized for weeks. He says the lengthy antibiotic IV treatment left him and his kidneys weak.
What should have been the prime of my life, my early 30s, when my friends are going out and, you know, doing fun events, they're camping, they're hiking, they're running, they're exercising. You know, I couldn't even make it up a single flight of stairs. And it just became no way to live your life.
Lovell also had a condition in which his blood sugar would fall dangerously low.
When you never know when you're just going to spontaneously black out and need to be rushed to the emergency room, it's a very scary way to live your life.
Lovell got a service dog that was trained to detect low blood sugar. An experimental drug he received at the Mayo Clinic bought him 3 years, but his kidneys were starting to fail. He needed dialysis 3 times a week. It takes hours each time. He thought he might need dialysis permanently. Lovell was on a waiting list for a kidney and pancreas for 4 years. In 2009, he got a call that he was eligible to receive organs from a teenager who had died.
That 18-year-old boy who suddenly passed away still lives on. His cells still live on inside me. So what could have been the end of his story, you know, isn't.
Lovell's story is one of many in which donated organs save lives. Carl Broman Chief Medical Officer John Wieland says it's sad there are not many more.
Nationwide, over 100,000 people are waiting for life-saving organ transplants. And each day, 17 people die because the organ they need is not available.
Surveys show 95% of the public supports organ donation. A Gift of Hope President and CEO Harry Wilkins says a much smaller percentage actually sign up.
We've always said, please don't take your organs to heaven, because heaven knows we need them here.
Wilkins calls those organ donors heroes. The brother of Bloomington resident Corey Briggs is an example. Briggs lost his brother Theodore 2 years ago. Corey says Theodore's legacy lives in 18 people who received his organs.
I feel kind of really great about that, because the simple fact that means a piece of him is still on this earth, still walking around, even though I can't see him, feel him, or know what part of him is in who.
Adam Lovell of Bloomington says he has not talked with the family of the 18-year-old whose kidney and pancreas changed his life. He says he feels it's up to the donor family to reach out if they want to. Before getting the new organs, Lovell says he barely had the energy to walk. 4 days after the surgery, he pushed aside his wheelchair and walked out of the hospital. Lovell is now in his 40s and says he's as active as ever. He bikes and hikes and likes to fish and kayak. He refuses to take elevators. He says he takes the stairs because he can. Lovell was also the president of Transplant Life Illinois, a group of organ recipient athletes who compete in the Transplant Games of America every 2 years. Still, Lovell knows his new organs have left him immunocompromised because of anti-rejection drugs he has to take. This became a worry, especially during the height of COVID.
Thankfully, you know, they were able to come through. A lot of us were able to get extra vaccination boosters long before many others, and that kind of really helped us out because it could have wiped out nearly all of the transplant community.
Now Lovell is focused on helping the transplant community grow. I'm Eric Stock.
In Illinois, anyone who wishes to donate their organs can sign up at lifegoeson.org or have it added to your driver's license.
Support for WGLT health coverage comes from Carle Health. You can count on Carle as your partner in health care. Information at carle.org.
Stories and conversations around Bloomington Normal and McLean County. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. Philosopher Kate Mann will give the keynote address tomorrow. It's at a symposium organized by the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department at Illinois State University. Mann is the author of two books on misogyny and sexism. They're titled Down Girl and Entitled. While many people use the words misogyny and sexism interchangeably, Mann draws a distinction between them. Here's a portion of her conversation with WGLT's Lauren Warnicke.
Metaphorically, I define misogyny as the law enforcement branch of patriarchy. So you can think of patriarchy consisting partly in these norms and expectations that say that women should be giving and loving and nurturing and perform reproductive and emotional and other forms of service labor. It's kind of like the police force of patriarchy that punishes especially women who are perceived as deviant according to these retrograde norms and expectations. Whereas I think of sexism more as a set of ideas and beliefs that has this wrong-headed idea that girls and women are naturally well-suited to caregiving roles, to these roles under patriarchy of giving and loving and nurturing, whereas men are more well suited to leadership and positions of power and authority.
I was especially intrigued by the section in Entitled where you talk about scientific research and specifically about women's bodies and how they are not the norm, right? The norm is to study men's bodies because they're less complicated. They don't have these hormonal fluctuations that makes it very difficult to find generalizability, let's say.
Absolutely.
I'm curious about, in your experience as a philosopher, if that is the same kind of framework that you encounter in philosophy, in that, oh, there's Plato and there's the canon, and that is largely written by men. And then there's feminist philosophy, as though philosophy and feminist philosophy are not the same thing.
Yeah, that's very astute, Lauren, because there is this sense that both when it comes to bodies and when it comes to minds, the cis white man, who we might also add, is assumed to be wealthy and non-disabled and straight or heterosexual rather than queer or gay, and also who is assumed to be thin rather than fat. This is like our default conception of both the body that is at the core of whom we care about, and also the mind whom we regard as authoritative and worthy of respect.
As the academy diversifies at a glacially slow pace, do you see any hope that your book will be highly irrelevant? You know, do you see signs of progress?
There are really promising signs of amazing scholarship going on in philosophy. You know, investigation of topics that have previously been neglected, although, as you've highlighted, we have a long way to go. So philosophy happens to be the most white male dominated discipline in the academy, at least in the humanities, but it's also on par with so-called pure mathematics and physics. We're at about 17% of tenure track and tenured professors in the U.S. are women.
Something that, strikes me is that, one, you're a woman, right? Writing from a feminist perspective, and your work is inherently readable. Often work that is produced by academics can be a little bit unapproachable. But the fact that you position this in real life with examples that we all know and hear and don't use too many big words makes me wonder how it is perceived in the academy.
I'm in a way not well positioned to know, because I expect a lot of the negative things that are said about this work are probably said not to my face, but by my past. So I have cultivated just an attitude of not caring if some people perceive it as insufficiently scholarly, because these are important topics and I want to reach people.
I wanted to ask a little bit about the concept of himpathy, and I think it really forms a foundation of your book entitled, and you start with the story of Brett Kavanaugh and how there was this dialogue between poor Christine Blasey Ford and, oh, poor Brett Kavanaugh, his life has been ruined because he's been embarrassed on national television and got the job anyway. And I think something that is, of course, of interest to me as a journalist is you point to this kind of false equivalence in the way that headlines are written about sexual violence, and like, let's try to be fair to the men and give them the benefit of the doubt, even though that backhandedly harms women more.
What I do in my work is I define himpathy, this kind of tongue-in-cheek neologism, is this idea of excessive or undue sympathy for the privileged male perpetrators of things like sexual assault, sexual harassment, intimate partner violence, even murder, who get this sympathy for their potentially ruined lives, supposedly, or lack of future opportunities they would otherwise have received, over female victims who we should be primarily sympathizing with and caring about. And the classic example of this is that of Brock Turner, who in the case of his sexual assault of Chanel Miller, who wrote the amazing memoir Know My Name, but despite the fact that she was the one who suffered, Brock Turner was the subject of sympathy from his friends, from his father, and even from the judge to some extent in the court case, who, you know, listened to accounts of his family and friends saying things like, oh, poor Brock can no longer enjoy a fresh ribeye steak off the grill. He feels, you know, bad, so his appetite has been ruined. Rather than the salient and morally vital sense that Chanel Miller was victimized by Brock Turner, and she should be the focus of our concern and sympathy.
Kate Mann's lecture on mansplaining and gaslighting takes place tomorrow afternoon at 1 in the Prairie Room at the Bone Student Center at ISU. And that's Sound Ideas today. WGLT's news magazine is made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. Thanks for listening. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media, part of the NPR network.